You're listening to the Mazingo Baseball Podcast. I'm your host, Harold Mazingo. Just a brief introduction on myself. I was a 15th round draft pick by the New York Mets in the 2003 MLB draft. And I was a 6th round pick by the Kansas City Royals in the 2006 MLB draft. I spent 6 seasons pitching professionally, and now I own Mazingo Baseball. And I am very excited to welcome y'all to the Mazingo Baseball Podcast. Enjoy. All right, welcome back to the Mazingo Baseball Podcast. Today's guest is fresh off of his pro day at Driveline. So Ryan, we sort of have a little bit of a history together. I was fortunate enough to work with Ryan a little bit back in high school. And for those kind of following along, as I mentioned, he's fresh off of his pro day at Driveline, so he's been out there working with Driveline. We're going to backtrack a little bit, getting into his story. So he went to Massaponics High School out here in Virginia, and then he went to Roanoke, which is a Division III school in the ODAC Conference, which is becoming a pretty good baseball conference, and he's kind of been just picked up and been training out at Driveline. So I'm going to let, Ryan, I'm going to let you kind of start the story where you may with this whole process for you.
So I went to Roanoke, was there for all 4 years, loved it there, ended up getting TJ my junior year, kind of late into my junior year, and made it back for my senior year, but was like never fully back for it. So then graduated and realized I didn't want to be done playing baseball, and so trained all throughout the summer, worked, saved up some money, and then moved out to Arizona and started training at Driveline. So I've been here since September.
Yeah, nice. So obviously I've been following along, and they've been putting out quite a bit of content on you, which is always cool to see because I like trying to follow your success there. So I do want to backtrack a little bit, and let's just talk about I always find it fascinating when, like, guys that go the D3 route are sort of pursuing and potentially, hopefully, getting into professional baseball. So I want to talk about your process, if you will, coming from high school, going to the D3 route. What did you feel, maybe this isn't the question I was going to ask originally, but what did you feel like, let me ask it this way. Do you feel like you were prepared to be at that level when you got there? Or what were some of the things that you weren't quite prepared for once you got to Roanoke?
I felt pretty prepared for college baseball. I mean, all throughout high school, like, I was pretty dedicated throughout high school. I just didn't see the results yet that I started to see in college, but I definitely did feel like the training and preparation I did, I didn't feel overwhelmed in college at all, and I felt pretty prepared for it.
Yeah, good, perfect. So I hope anyone listening sort of can take away from that a little bit, being that, so again, I was fortunate enough to work with Ryan a little bit back in high school. Ryan did put in a ton of work and really asked a lot of the right questions. So I was hoping that he was going to answer that way, but it will lead me into the next one. Was there anything that you were sort of surprised by once you got not in a negative way, but was there anything that you were surprised by once you got on campus at Roanoke?
D3 baseball, I know, like, people don't have, like, the highest opinion of it because, like, it's the lowest level of college baseball, but very surprising about, like, how many talented players were at the D3 level. I mean, the ODAC has a few players in pro ball now, and hopefully I'll be able to join them soon. And I know there are a few players that will be seniors this year that will probably also be in pro ball next year. So, I mean, it was surprising just how talented a lot of players were.
Yeah, so, again, you couldn't have answered that any better. There is sort of this misconception on Division III baseball, right? And a lot of it sort of comes with a stigma, and guys – like, almost don't want to admit they're going the D3 route. But fortunately for me, I never had a ton of experience with a Division III level, but when some of the athletes like yourself were coming along and I'm following y'all's careers through college, I really got some experience and exposure with just how much talent there was in the ODAC in particular, in the state of Virginia at the Division III level. I know that there's some talk about a kid. I won't mention a name, but there's some talk about a kid that plays in the ODAC that was up to like 99 miles an hour in summer ball a few years ago, and that just kind of is not what you think of per se, or people don't usually think of when they think about like the Division III baseball route. So it's been pretty cool for me to grow along with that and really help kids understand the best fit going forward with them as well.
Yeah, and I think in the past few years, at least on the pitching side and hitting side, but especially on the pitching side, just like with the velocity at the D3 level, it's been getting pretty crazy. Because my freshman year, I was up to 92, and there might have been one or two kids we saw all year that threw harder than me. And then at our conference tournament this past May, we had like just on our team alone, we had eight different guys be over 90. It's getting pretty crazy.
Yeah, no, it really is. And one of the really cool things, at least I think is cool, that's happening, especially with the ODAC schools, is the amount of resources they're expending on player development stuff now. I know it's beneficial on the recruiting side, but having those pieces in place when guys get on campus, and especially the ones that are familiar with the tools to start with, I think that's really, really grown what's going on at the Division III level. And it was already in a good place in Virginia, with the ODAC, but I think it's really been expedited here over the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if athletes dedicated, they can definitely go to Division III and see a lot of gains and a lot of development.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you're 100% right. I work with quite a bit of guys that are in the ODAC, so it's been really cool, and they're all at different schools. So it's been really cool. Not all the schools, I'm not going to go that route, but most of the schools, a lot of the schools, I'll say, are really investing the time and resources into this stuff. So it's been really cool. But let's jump back into you in particular here. You left Roanoke, you went out to Driveline, and I've been, again, following some of the stuff they've been putting out about you. But what is it that you have been sort of working on, if you will, and just kind of run us through that process. I want to lead this all the way through your pro day, and you can talk to us about how that experience was and just the atmosphere and all of that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, so basically the two biggest things I've been working on since I've been out here is just moving better, being more efficient mechanically, for ultimately to increase velocity, and then also working on a slider.
Yeah, so if again, I'm gonna give you some freedom here. You can talk as much or as little as you want on these two subjects right there, but I think I could be wrong, but I think I remember there being a tweet out about what you were working on specifically, and one of them was sort of what your front hip was doing. If you want to talk on that, I'd love to sort of discuss it.
Yeah, so doing the motion captures, we could see that my pelvis peaks rotational velocity before foot plant, and that's very abnormal for high velocity throwers. Because most of the time you would think you get the impulse from the lead leg block at foot plant finishing pelvis rotation. And so that's really when your pelvis should peak. And so me peaking pelvis rotational velocity before foot plant is could be a sign that I'm not really using the block at all. And so that's just if I could increase my rotational pelvis velocity and actually utilize the lead leg block, I mean that's just could be a significant amount of velo there that I'm just not getting right now.
Yeah, so I'm gonna dive in, and again, if you're not comfortable answering some of this stuff, I'm cool with that too. But I am very curious, just because of what I do. Do you in turn have very high torso rotational velocities?
I'm not too sure. I mean, I could check the bio mechanics report, but I think my torso rotational velocity was pretty average, if I remember.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking in my head along the lines of, man, like, and I don't know, I didn't get too specific with exactly what was going on there with your front hip or anything like that, but I was just wondering if you were just, so obviously there's a lot of stuff with, like, everyone sort of moves in their own certain pattern, right? And I was just kind of wondering, specifically with you, like, were you getting peak rotational velocity, or not peak, but really high rotational velocities elsewhere that were making up for that, and that's sort of where you're getting most of your velocity from?
Yeah, so one thing that I actually do really well, that I think where I generate most of my velocity, is I get a huge pec stretch, and I get into a lot of horizontal abduction with my throwing arm. And so Jogline actually has like mechanical scores where they look at like different parts of the delivery to see like what you do well, what you don't. And for like the arm action score, I was 99th percentile. So I think that's probably where I'm getting most of my velo right now.
Yeah, so I find that stuff extremely fascinating. Just like seeing how that we always want to put like these boxes on all these different categories, right? And what we always sort of see is that, like, the more elite athletes, a lot of them have several deficiencies. They just make up for it elsewhere. And that's a fascinating thing with the human body that is just wild to see for me. So it's pretty cool to hear you talk about that stuff. So let's jump into the slider.
Absolutely.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh,
no, so I was gonna say, let's jump into the slider. What's the deal with the slider? Tell us.
Yeah, so coming back from TJ, I just really never had any feel for a breaking ball since coming back. So I was just looking at some secondary pitch, or be able to get a secondary pitch that was, like, actually a plus. So with the slider, we decided on throwing a slider first because you're – the most effective pitch in baseball by quite a wide margin. And we just threw a couple baseline bullpens to see where it's at, and then decided on a goal for where we needed to be. And then it was just trial and error with the Edutronic camera to just see what I need to do to get to that goal.
Yeah, love it. Love it, love it, love it, love it. That's kind of the biggest probably misconception when it comes to like pitch design stuff, is I think people think like, oh, I can just do this and it's going to be good, right? It takes a massive amount of trial and error to really figure out what is going to work best for the individual. And it's not like a really simple process to it for most people, right? So how long did it sort of take you to really get that slider dialed in?
I've been working on it since probably November, I think, or maybe even earlier than that, but I still wouldn't say it's, like, completely dialed.
Oh, well, it'll never be completely dialed in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so,
yeah,
I mean,
so
obviously,
it's just a continuous work in progress.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I saw some of the sliders you threw on your pro day, I assume you would fall into the category of what we call a sweeping slider. Kind of correct with that?
Yeah.
So I'm just curious now again, and I think it's a cool conversation. Was there a discussion between more gyro slider versus sweeping slider?
Yeah, so it was basically about how many ticks off my fastball it would be. And so it was like, if I threw a gyro slider, I would need it to be like around 8 miles per hour off my fastball, versus if I threw a sweeping slider, it could be around like 12 to 13. And basically I was just closer with the sweeping slider than a gyro slider. Because for a gyro slider, it'd be pretty good. You have to throw it really hard.
Yeah, no, this is leading to a pretty cool conversation. Yes, two very different sliders. Typically, for me, not to make this about me, but typically what I try to do is if guys have pretty good curveballs, then I would, and again, this is typical because what you just said absolutely matters. Like the velocity separation on a gyro slider absolutely matters immensely, right? But typically, I try to get the guys that throw a decent curveball to have more of a gyro slider. But there are instances where those guys throw some sweepers too. But what I tend to see is that the guys that try to throw a sweeper and a curveball, they sort of start blending together after a while. So we just usually go right to the gyro slider if we can get it. But I'm fascinated with the sweeping slider, and yours looked pretty sharp there on that pro day. Did you get any feedback on that slider? Agreed.
I was a little disappointed I wasn't able to throw it hard because I think it only averaged like 80.6. Hopefully I can bump that up to be able to average like 82 to 83. But yeah, I was pretty happy with it.
Yeah, I thought it looked good. All right, so let's I do want to I'd probably be remiss if we didn't talk about your Tommy John and the recovery part of that. I always think that's an important piece for parents of the younger kids to sort of hear. I know Tommy John has become something very, very common with baseball pitchers, but it's still not like some sort of a route we want to take if we can. And a lot of people still like just think that, oh, let's have Tommy John, I'm automatically going to throw harder, right? And that is not exactly a route that we want to go down if we don't have to. It's starting to look more and more inevitable that everyone's going to get it that pitches at a high level, but we don't want that to be the case. So let's talk about your journey with Tommy John. Like, how did that come about? And then just talk about the recovery process.
Yeah, so going into my junior year, I was up to 95, feeling really good about heading into the season, and then I had like strained a muscle in my back, like nothing too serious, but I couldn't throw for probably about 3.5 weeks. And so coming back from that, like my junior year, I want to get drafted, I want to be able to pitch for my team, help the team out, and so I kind of rushed back from the back injury, didn't really have a proper ramp up. And when you don't have a proper ramp up, you just set yourself up for injury, and that's what happened.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's an important piece, especially this time of year, for people to understand. It's not about, and I'm really talking about high school kids here now. Hopefully, the college kids are a little bit different. Obviously, I'm familiar with a lot of those programs where they shut them down at the wrong time and try to get them to pick up right at the Christmas break. And that's not nearly enough time usually. But the high school kids, like, we shouldn't be just picking up a baseball now. There should have, I typically want guys at least 8 weeks, but preferably 12 weeks before we're really getting heavy and getting after it. But way too many are still picking up a ball like right now and trying to start winging it on day three and think that they're going to be fine. Eventually, that's going to catch up to you. But so.
Yeah, no, I definitely believe the most dangerous time for throwing is right when you start, right after you took a break from throwing.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, so let's talk about the recovery. Well, first off, did you have full-blown TJ?
Yeah, I had full-blown TJ. The
Okay.
surgeon said I could potentially have the internal brace, which is a little bit of a shoulder recovery, but I opted to just get full TJ.
Okay, cool. Well, not, but
Yeah.
tell me about the recovery process for that. Who did your surgery? Just curious.
Oh, shoot, I can't remember his name now. It was a surgeon in Richmond.
Oh man, I'm not gonna cut that out either. I hope he listens. No, I'm just messing.
Yeah, sorry to him. He did a good job, though.
No, good, you're good. Hey, so when you came out of surgery, was your arm sort of locked for a while?
Yeah, so I was in the cast for like the first 2 days, I think, and then went to the surgeon's office, and he took me out of the cast, I think after 3 days, 4 days maybe. And then right after those 3, 4 days, he started having me do exercises of putting my arm into flexion and extension. Like, I never had my, the only time my brace was, like, locked in place was when I would go to sleep. But all the other times, I was never locked in the brace.
Yeah, and if anyone doesn't know what he means when he says flexion and extension, he means bending and extending his arm. Because that is something that is vital to recovering from Tommy John. It can sometimes be a pain in the butt and take forever to get that back. So how long did it take you to regain most of your range of motion with flexion and extension?
I think most of the range of motions was within the first month. And by 6 weeks, I think it was completely normal.
Nice. I know that was, and I don't know if there's a difference in technique that they're sort of doing now or not, but so I had Tommy John in 2008. And I know that it was taking a few months for a lot of the guys to regain flexion and extension. And it was sort of more of a slow process, and maybe they're just trying to speed up the rehabilitation process with the protocols there. I don't know, but that has been something. I've dealt with a few guys that have had Tommy John, and that's been the one thing that I've always found very interesting and fascinating, is just how much quicker they're gaining flexion and extension now versus really not that long ago, back in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, even one of my teammates who got Tommy John about a year before I did, I don't think he got back to full flexion and extension until like the 4 month mark.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking. It was somewhere around like 3 months for a lot of guys. We were like 12 weeks trying to still regain to where we could touch our shoulders for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing those flexion and extension exercises like 3 times a day every day during the first 2 months.
So I'm taking way back now to 2008 when this all happened. Did you have trainers actively stretching you into flexion and extension, or was this all on your own?
That was just on my own.
Yeah, so there was a little bit of controversy at the time when I had mine on whether or not trainers should be actively stretching into flexion and extension. I guess I'll leave the one story alone, but there was a lot of aggressive stretching going on at the time, and I'll just kind of leave that one at that.
Yeah, I mean, I was like pushing and pulling my arm into flexion and extension. I mean, I wasn't like really cranking it, but I was definitely like putting some pressure to push into flexion and extension.
Yeah, nice. All right, so did you start throwing? How long before you started throwing? Month 4, month 3? Where were you at there?
I think it was 4.5.
Yeah,
that's roughly. I'm not too sure on that, but I'm pretty sure it was 4.5 months in. Yeah. I mean, the throwing started really, like, the first few days were really, really easy throwing.
Right. And how about, did you have any setbacks along the way with your recovery?
No, I mean, I never really, when I was throwing, coming back, I never had any pain in my arm at all.
Nice. Again, didn't want to make this about me, but I'm thinking about a story, so I figured I would share it here now. I was coming along fairly well with my recovery, and I got to the point where I threw my first bullpen, and walking back to the clubhouse in Surprise, Arizona, my arm locked up. Just literally, I was just walking back to the clubhouse, and my arm locked up like I had just come out of surgery all over again, and it took me a few weeks to regain the range of motion back. It was the craziest thing. Obviously, you start questioning everything at that point, but it was just a wild turn of events.
Did you feel like your bullpen was at like a lot higher intensity than any of your throwing before that?
I don't know how to answer that. I don't think so. We got out to 120. That's as far as we could go. So probably, now that I'm saying that. So our rehab throwing program put us out to 120 feet. We did that for like 2 weeks. And then it was 120 feet and then a bullpen. But it was like 10 pitches. That's all it was. Nice and easy.
Yeah.
And just walking back, everything felt great. And then walking back, just locked up and couldn't do anything.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember when the surgeon first handed me the return to throw program. And I remember looking at it thinking, there's just no way I'm doing this.
Right. Yeah, we didn't have anything else at that time, though, Ryan.
Yeah. No, it was probably the same throwing program you did.
I'm sure. I think they're all pretty similar anyways. It's like 15 throws at 60 feet, or sorry, 45 feet.
Yeah.
Then rest. You do that for like 3 days, and then you got two sets of 15 at 45 feet, then you add it, then you go to 60 and 2 weeks at 60 feet, then 75, then a little bit at 90, then 105, then 120, then you can start throwing the mound. But it just takes forever to get back that far. It's like 2 weeks of every station.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, all good. But man, things were going along fairly smooth for me, and then once that thing locked up, they just did not go very well from there. It took me 20 months to really feel somewhat normal again. Not a fun process.
Yeah, I was feeling. I mean, like I said, the whole time my arm felt good, but I didn't really feel like I was. I felt like I was healthy. I didn't really feel like I was back to the level that I was pre-TJ. Probably till about like 12, 13 months, I would say.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good time frame.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, good stuff. I think this is important for people to hear. So I'm going to kind of leave the next one open for you to lead a discussion here. So I want you to sort of talk about the advice you would give to high school kids that are going through the recruiting process, and in particular, ones that may feel like they're being under-recruited to a degree, and they're contemplating this Division III route.
So if any kid, like my biggest recruiting advice to any high schooler is to be good enough. I mean, if I have one regret from high school, it's from me playing showcase baseball during the fall and summer instead of training. Because I did not throw hard enough and I was not a good enough player to just be going out and doing showcases. If you're good enough, you'll probably get recruited. I mean, if you can throw 90 miles per hour, a lot of teams are going to find spots for you. And so if you're a pitcher, that should be your number one goal.
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to make that distinction. I was going to say, if you're a pitcher, hitters are a little bit different, but pitchers,
yeah,
for sure, 100%.
But, I mean, it's kind of the same thing, definitely not to the extent of pitchers. But, like, if you're a hitter and you just don't hit the ball hard enough, like, that needs to be your number one goal.
Yes, 100%. I just meant as far as the recruiting goes. Like,
yeah,
it's going to be hard for hitters to hear recruiting
like
without seeing them hit live. Go ahead, sorry. Not to interrupt.
They just need like a, like as a hitter, I know it's harder to be recruited just like off of Twitter. Like, if you're a pitcher and you post a Twitter video and you just have nasty stuff, like, you'll get interest. But as a hitter, that's a lot more difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. What else you got for him? Anything else?
I don't think so. I mean, just, yeah, as a high schooler, I wouldn't concern myself. If I could go back again, I wouldn't concern myself with being recruited as much as just being good enough. Because you'll probably end up at the level where you fit. So you just want to make sure you fit at the level you want to be at. Because coming out of high school, like, I wanted to go Division I, too, but I threw low 80s, you know? No amount of showcases were going to make a low 80s right-handed pitcher a Division I level pitcher, you know?
Yep, no, absolutely. That was about as perfect of a piece of advice as you could have gave, Ryan. That was awesome. So, look, before we wrap up, I hope that anyone's listening will sort of follow Ryan, because I love the story. I'm always a huge fan of the kids that weren't the most heavily recruited, and they just keep on pushing and pushing and pushing, and they don't listen to what anyone has to say, right? They don't fall into the stigma of, oh, I'm Division III. That's just kind of where the journey ends. That's just a stop along the way, right? Like there is a window that obviously eventually will close, but that doesn't happen when you're 18 years old. There's still plenty of growth to be ahead of you. So I just love the kids and love the stories of the people that sort of bet on themselves, and you going out and just training at a place like Driveline, and just continuing to work and work and work, going through Tommy John, not being recruited to the level that you were hoping for, right? Like, those are easy things to say, okay, enough's enough, right? And you just continue to bet on yourself, and I absolutely love that. So, Ryan, I know coming off your pro day, there was a lot of teams out there at the Driveline thing, so obviously I'm always rooting for you and pulling for you, so I'm hoping that you're going to get some good news here soon. But I do want you to tell people sort of where they can follow along and find you at. Like, tell them your Twitter account, Instagram, wherever you are, so they can follow along.
Yeah, I mean, Ryan Cloud Twitter. On Twitter, it's just Ryan Cloud. Don't have any other social media, and I don't tweet too much, so you can follow me if you like, but I don't put out too much.
No, you may not tweet a lot, but you get tweeted about from time to time with some very good information.
Yeah.
So there's always a bonus to that as well. But I'm hoping that in the next few weeks or so, at least, maybe quicker than that, that I am going to see a tweet about where your next destination is going to be. So I'm looking forward to seeing that one. I'm going to leave it up to you one last time. If there's anything else that any piece of advice or any sort of thing that you find fascinating that you might want to discuss, we can discuss it. If not, we're going to just sit back and wish you the best of the luck and continue to follow you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just number one advice is just be good enough. Don't concern yourself with where you are. I mean, just consider where you're going. You know, be good enough for whatever level you want to play at. That should always be the goal. You know, it doesn't matter if you're Division III or undrafted free agent. You know, if you have the talent level to play at the level you want to go to, you'll get there.
Hey, so I am gonna I'm gonna give you a hard time about something I remember about you, Ryan, and I'm gonna tell hitters, any hitter that ever wants to talk to Ryan, you probably don't want to listen to his advice, okay? Because Ryan just wants you to pull the ball in the air so he can try to strike you out with his newfound slider. That's all he's trying to do.
Hey, no, pull the ball in the air.
That's just what I remember. Everything was, everything, pull the ball in the air. Hit it hard in the pull side.
Pull the ball in the air. It's all you need to do. It's what the best hitters at every level do.
Yeah, let's leave that to the professionals on the hitting side there, Ryan.
Hey, I'm All-State DH. I know what I'm talking about.
All-State DH. Hey, he did hit bombs.
Yeah.
Nice, nice, nice. All right, well, Ryan, this has been great. I appreciate you coming on. And like I said, we're going to continue to follow you, and best of luck, and we're hoping for some good news soon.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me, Harold.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks for listening to the Mazingo Baseball Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the channel so you can get notified when the latest episodes are coming out. Share it with all your friends. Leave us a review. Be sure to check me out on all the social media accounts. It's going to be at Mazingo Baseball. And check out the website, mazingobaseball.com.